across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello, all you friends of Freeman, and welcome to the Free Zone here on FreemanTV.com. I want to thank you all for tuning in live here every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. But if you can't make it to the live show, it's streamed out in many different ways. You can find the Free Zone on Stitcher. You can find it on iTunes and on YouTube. We're going to try and find many media streams for you to follow. And we are working on making this bigger, better, bolder, and brighter. It's all going to be coming your way, and it's all thanks to your support. Thank you so much for subscribing to Freeman TV. In tonight's show, we are going to be talking with William Ramsey, author of Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order. We're going to investigate what's so bad about Aleister Crowley and look into Crowley's pandemic influence and the consequences it has had on the 21st century, putting into the lips of many of the youth today, "Do what thou wilt." And what is wrong with this? Well, you may just find that you're a Thelemite and you don't even know it. So welcome to the show, William Ramsey. I'm very excited about this talk.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm glad to be here.
It's going to be a good time. Let's jump back to 1875 and the birth of Mr. Edward Alexander Crowley.
Yeah, he was born in England to an upper-class family. He considered his birth to be like a distinguishing event. He considers himself to be kind of like a Buddha. He was born into a very religious Christian family. They were a subpart of the Plymouth Brethren called the Exclusive Brethren. And he was brought up in a very religious household in an upper class family. And he had all the privileges of a spoiled kid. He changed after his father died. He became kind of anti-Christian, and he identified himself with a lot of the darker aspects of the Bible, the beast. And, he really liked Revelations. It was one of his favorite books in the Bible.
Well, there was a lot of torment in his youth, right? His family was abusive.
Well, that was rumored to be the case. He really thought his mom was very shrill and cold. And that's kind of why he changed after his father died, is that his mother was, very rigid, is what he considered to be very rigid. And he wanted to rebel against that.
Right. I mean, my mother was raised abused by Catholics in a Catholic school and was actually rescued by the Nazis against her Catholic abusers. And this turned my mom, away from religion. It just was one of those things. Crowley also went through a lot of torment with school and with his upbringing, trying to deal with other people, right?
That's very true. And he went to private schools, but the private schools in 19th century England were very abusive. So you're right on that element. He was kind of kicked out of school. He was beaten at school. There were bullies. You know, it was kind of like something from Pink Floyd's The Wall or something, this abusive teachers. And he almost actually died at one of the boarding schools. He called it a boyhood in hell.
Wow. And,
so he definitely, I think, took from those kind of Christian schools, too, an anger towards those institutions as well. And, he was punished severely. He said he was compelled to solitude for months at a time. And, it was very rough. And I think he went to three or four different private schools. In England, those schools are kind of the schools for the upper class, or they call them public schools.
So the Plymouth Brethren, although sounding like they are some sort of, locked away group, like they're off in an abbey somewhere, it sounds more like the Plymouth Brethren may have had some money.
Well, they were definitely a very intense sect. The guy who started the Plymouth Brethren was by the name of Darby. He was a famous preacher. And, he had a privileged upbringing in that sect, no doubt about it.
Okay. Well, so we have this child being in a strict religious organization, his family. He's not coping in school very well with the the aristocratic children that he has to deal with. When was the moment when he decided to turn to the dark side? You know, as it were, when did Crowley reach the crossroads and why did he pick Satan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that he kind of eased his way into it, but certainly that moment where he really changed was when he went off to school at Cambridge. That was when he really dedicated himself to the occult. But even as a kid, he had written about, he had a very long autobiography that he wrote, and he confessed in that autobiography that as a young child, he murdered a local cat. You know, he had heard that they had nine lives, and he wanted to basically kill the cat. He said, and this is like a direct quote, "I therefore caught a cat, having administered a large dose of arsenic. I chloroformed it, hanged it above a gas jet, stabbed it, cut its throat, smashed its skull, and when it had been pretty thoroughly burnt, drowned it and threw it out of the window that the fall might remove the ninth life. Now, in fact, the operation was successful. I killed the cat." And he says, "I remember that all the time I was generally sorry for the animal, but I simply forced myself to carry out the experiment in the interest of pure science. So he basically had that kind of detached cruelty that was indicative of his character later on in life.
Right. So we see that right on in the very beginnings. I mean, you know, yeah, anyone doing this would need to be hospitalized, I would think, if they were found out.
Yeah, I would say so, for sure. And he, you know, he said, like, when he got to, to Cambridge, he said, "I was part of the glories of the past at Cambridge, but I made a firm resolution to be one of the glories of the future." So you see this overriding ambition of a younger person to make his mark.
Right.
You know, I think that he said that he was white hot on three subjects: climbing, so he was an accomplished mountain climber; poetry, and magic. So he was definitely, magic is kind of synonymous with the occult.
Is there truth to the story that he left people on the mountain to die?
Yes. So that is a later on in his life. He went to the one mountain that was kind of smaller than Mount Everest. It was called, it's called K2. It's Kanchenjunga is what they called it back then. But he had taken a group up there, a variety of different Europeans, a Frenchman, and there was an avalanche, and he refused to leave his tent to go help rescue the people who were stricken.
Just like the cat, I guess.
Yeah, so, and he also made, like, really cruel statements about other people who died in other mountains. You know, there was another accident that took place while he was climbing in Switzerland. So he was able to travel freely with his large inheritance that he had. But he basically kind of gave somebody bad advice, and a whole family of Englishmen died.
Wow. And then he makes jokes about it.
Correct. So he says, this is a direct quote. He says, "Some years later, I made a blunder of the same kind, which resulted in a frightful tragedy. I was, you know," basically to paraphrase, he was in Switzerland. He said that, there was an a place that, you know, people hadn't climbed before. But he said, "The rocks do overhang. The colds are so good that the climb is quite easy." But then he said he and his three children attempted to repeat the same climb he had done, and all three were killed. And he says, "A particularly English incident adds a touch of grotesque grimness to the story. The widow, the wife of the family who died, wanted to go see the bodies. And she said she'd been brought up to fancy people's lying in state. But as a matter of fact, all the remains had been brought down in one sack. No one could tell what was whose."
Wow.
Yeah, so pretty grim kind of humor over the death of somebody who he gave him bad advice to.
All right. So we're getting a bit of the character of Aleister Crowley here. We see that he, you know, through a strict upbringing, was a strict religious upbringing, was turned to the ideas of being Satan himself. And at Cambridge, is this when he started to discover the Golden Dawn, start to prepare his battles with MacGregor Mathers? I mean, one look at MacGregor Mathers and I probably would give him flack too, but you know.
Yes, I would definitely say that was the time he really started venturing off into a kind of occult books, and he came across one that, you know, led him, that he heard that there was basically a secret group of people, and he wanted to discover what there was. There was basically an intermediary, and he made his way into the Golden Dawn. Like there, he, you know, and in his time, that the, there was a flourishing occultism in the era of that, you know, the British Empire. So, you know, there was Helena Petrovna Blavatsky was in London at the time, and aristocrats went to her society for her Theosophic Center, and she had a society for psychical research. So a lot of people were interested in that stuff, and Crowley became, you know, one of those people who, you know, followed in that kind of footstep with other kind of luminaries of the time, like William Butler Yeats. So yeah, he made his way through all of the steps. The Golden Dawn had this hierarchy of kind of initiation and grades that you had to go through, and Crowley really applied himself and went through those grades as fast as he could. And you can see he has something in his kind of in his papers where he writes the dates that he went through the grades of the Golden Dawn.
Well, he was a master of the Bible, I would imagine.
And he was. He referenced the Bible. He was a noted scholar. He wrote tracts about how bogus the Bible was from a position of somebody who was very knowledgeable about it. And he actually, when he decided to kind of create his own religion, he integrated many concepts and themes from the Bible into his religion, like the concept of the Scarlet Woman and the Beast. So he became kind of a beast, and he had through his life these women who were kind of ritual partners to him that he called the Scarlet Women.
But do you know a bit about the magical warfare that MacGregor Mathers of the Golden Dawn and Crowley would have, and what this would be like?
Yes, I know a lot about that. Basically, MacGregor Mathers was his kind of master as he went through. He actually had he really didn't respect anybody, but one of the strange things about his writings was he had a lot of admiration at one time for this guy, MacGregor Mathers. He actually thought he was authoritative. He said about Mathers, he had that habit of authority, which inspires confidence because it never doubts itself. So, you know, he regarded MacGregor Mathers as a magician of extraordinary attainments. It's almost kind of like something out of Harry Potter, their relationship of this kind of master and kind of student. And eventually what would happen is Crowley took oaths of secrecy never to divulge a lot of the information that Mathers had acquired, and Crowley then decided later on to publish that. And there was actually they came to a lawsuit, and there was a lawsuit, and all the records of this lawsuit between Crowley and Mathers exist. And the judges were amused by, you know, these two oddballs in kind of magical dress arguing over copyrights.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, Mathers was very important in the occult in a lot of ways, because he was a person who translated the Lesser Key of Solomon, the Goetia, about the 72 demons. So Mathers really had a lot of credibility because he went into a lot of the old libraries and dug up, you know, old documents. He really was kind of a scholar. He wrote something important about the Kabbalah. He called it the Kabbalah Unveiled. So all this stuff that he had accrued to include in the Golden Dawn, you know, these magical traditions of Egypt, the Kabbalah, the Tarot, esotericism from all over Western, really was something in a basis of everything Crowley did later on in his life.
So what turned the tide?
Well, I think that what happened is that he, Crowley, what happened is eventually, you know, Mathers thought he was like basically a servant of the secret chiefs or the old gods. So, you know, he received this stuff from the secret chiefs. And I think what happened is Crowley grew up enough where, you know, he felt that he was kind of like, there was something that happened that basically drove Crowley to kind of want to overreach over Mathers. And that brought them to an end. They basically, you know, split ways. Mathers moved to Paris. He actually had started another kind of adjunct to the Golden Dawn in Paris, and Crowley kind of, you know, carried on with kind of Mathers's view. Basically, what happened, I think, specifically is what Mathers, Crowley wanted to go into like the second order of the Golden Dawn, and I think, you know, I think that what happened is that, let's see. Yeah, there was basically just an argument, and then they split up. I can't remember the specifics of it.
Okay. But then they eventually started magical battles and trying to affect each other on the astral plane. And I believe Crowley wrote somewhat of a mocking book about McGregor Mathers with some lengthy title for the magician, because McGregor always had these lengthy titles, right?
Yeah, so he had very florid titles. Yeah, so he definitely had something. I think what he said about Mathers, he said, the master proved to be no master, the order no order, but the incarnation of disorder. And, so that's what he kind of remembers about the Golden Dawn. He also had, he had an argument with Yeats over kind of a lodge. And, it all kind of fell apart.
So just one last thing on the Golden Dawn. Would they have a temple or a, established building?
Yeah, I think that the Golden Dawn actually operated out of, if I remember correctly, they operated out of an old Masonic lodge. So they had a Masonic lodge somewhere in London that they used for their kind of rituals.
All right. Well, then that leads to Crowley and his Freemasonic connections, because right about then, after leaving there, he goes off to Mexico, right, and starts to work his way into another order.
Right. So he supposedly made the 33rd degree by some guy named Don Jesus Jesus Medina. So that was where he became the head of the top of the Masonic grades. And he also was kept on through his magical practices in Mexico. So he said that he laid the basis of a sound magical and mystical technique while he was in Mexico. One of the interesting things about Crowley, he really was a world traveler. He had access to all these countries. He circumnavigated the globe twice back, in the 19th century when it was a lot harder to travel. He had to go by train and boat. But all the time that he was traveling, he was constantly involved in magical practices. So you these strange kind of workings that he did were, would show up he'd be in Southern Asia or Egypt or Mexico or even New York. So, he has a very kind of convoluted, it's difficult to kind of track him down at any specific time because he was all over the place.
Was he already into drugs at this point?
I don't think that he really heavily got into drugs. I think he was always a smoker and a drinker, so kind of like the standard drugs, but he really turned into somebody who was experimenting in drugs right kind of after, after he came to the United States is really, I think, when that he turned into adding drugs into his ritual routines.
So he's a Freemason. He's been through the Golden Dawn, and but he really wants to form Crowleyanity, doesn't he? He wants to take this to his own level.
I think so. I mean, I think that he's always working to become a master of mysticism. So he's constantly trying to find all that really worldly knowledge and wisdom that he can. So not only is he going through the Golden Dawn and through, understanding everything about Masonry, he's trying to learn stuff from Eastern mysticism. So he's doing Buddhism, yoga, he's trying to understand what the Hindu gurus are up to. So, back in the time before yoga was popularized in the West, he was really trying to become a master of that and also the Buddhist states. So these different states of, supposedly within Buddhism, where you have different states of consciousness.
Well, this is a man with a lot of dedication.
Indeed. I mean, what he was able to do because of his vast wealth, which is, it was something like when he received his inheritance, it was estimated to be in today's numbers about $20 million. So it really afforded him time to really, dedicate himself to this knowledge. And unlike other people, he really was dedicated. He was a very natively intelligent person, and he had the time and inclination really to become really what he wanted, which was, what he considered himself and what he wrote about himself in his autobiography, which is one of the great figures of human history. So he put himself in this group, this group of people like Buddha, Christ, Muhammad, Lao Tzu, and Confucius. So he really thought, he had a very florid and grandiose opinion of himself.
Right.
And in a lot of ways it played out. I mean, to be honest with you, he did write tons and tons of articles. he was an incredible literateur. He wrote tons of books. He had his own encyclopedia of occultism. He called the Equinox. So he really did, whether he attained what he wanted, he really did. He was a remarkable character once I found out about him. I mean, yeah.
How did you come across Aleister Crowley?
The reason for the title of the book is that I was an investigator into 9/11. At some point between like 2004, 2005, I realized that the whole thing didn't make sense. It didn't add up, Building 7. But when I was researching, I kept coming across these numbers. I was never into the occult. I was raised Catholic, I'm not really a practicing Catholic now. But, you know, I kept seeing these numbers, and they were there in too much frequency to be anomalies, you know, to be random. So I was trying to figure out what was the importance of these numbers, 11, 77, 93, 175. And through my research, you know, 93 is a specific Crowley number, and we can go into that in greater detail, but it led me back to Crowley and Crowley's ideas of the world and his past and what, for me, what 9/11 represented, which was this incredible world change that that it caused, you know, that really changed so much. And I saw there was an undergirding of occultism, and for me specifically, led back to Crowley. Well, just to follow on to that, when I started reading Crowley, I was trying to figure out who this character was. So I read all the biographies and all this stuff, and there were very pro-Crowley biographies out there and some who didn't. So what that led me to do is go back and actually read core Crowley material. So I had to go back and, you know, I investigated Crowley through a lot of very significant libraries and resources that are there. And so I had a completely different understanding and view of Crowley than some of his more sympathetic biographers had. So I saw him as kind of a darker figure and a malevolent figure. And thus I titled the book Prophet of Evil. And what Crowley thought of himself really was a prophet of a new aeon, a new era, somebody who really wanted to make change in the world. And I saw 9/11 as part of that desire to make change that was post his death in 1947.
Well, yeah. And as we follow through his life here, we're going to see how influential Aleister Crowley was in the manufacture of the New World Order and the 21st century. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And the study of his works, oh my God, I feel for you there, William. You know, that's no easy read, that's for sure. And the height of what Crowley is shown in the fact that his Book of the Law, this book that was channeled by Rose, and I want to talk to you about that, but the Book of the Law is actually housed at the Harry Ransom Center on the University of Texas campus.
Right.
And
I've actually looked through a lot of Crowley's old material from there. It's very fascinating.
It's amazing, right? So it's not like this was some flight of fancy fellow, although he was king of the tabloids. His works are stored in universities. His works are studied and on the shelves of every Masonic temple around the world. And his magic has influenced every rock and roll group and celebrity. You know, we're going to get to so much of that as we go along. But let's talk about the Book of the Law for a minute, because this is what really developed the concept of the Thelema and laid out the idea of the Aeon of Horus.
Very true. So what, you know, Crowley was traveling around the world on his way back from Asia. He stopped in Egypt with his wife, Rose, and she was kind of like a medium for him. And what she said to him is, they're waiting for you. He wanted to know what it was. And he says that the Book of the Law was a received book that he didn't expect. So what happened, what she said actually specifically was that the person who was waiting was Horus. So it ties right into your statement, Aeon of Horus. So, and Rose knew nothing about magic or Egyptology. She was not interested in what Crowley was interested in. So to Crowley, that was a fascinating moment for him. What he did is he went to the Bullock Museum, which is now the Egyptian Museum, and he found a stela that is actually the number 666 in the Egypt Museum, and basically it had three gods on it: Nuit, Hadit, and Rahurkut, who was kind of like a form of a Horus on the stela. So that had great significance to Crowley. He went back to his, place that his apartment and started doing rituals. And on the days of April 8th, 9th, and 10th, he received over his shoulder something called the Book of the Law. And it's a fascinating, amazing book. He said that he was alone, but he's a being that announced itself as Iwas appeared behind him on each occasion and, you know, told this, spoke this book to him in a deep timbre, musical and expressive, its tone solemn, voluptuous, tender, fierce. So, you know, depending upon the mood of the message, the book is in three segments. And the third segment is extremely aggressive. But he says, Crowley says, and this is a quote, "The immense superiority of this particular intelligence, Iwas, to any other with which mankind has yet to be in conscious communication is shown not merely by the character of the book itself, but the fact of his comprehending perfectly the nature of the proof necessary to demonstrate the fact of his own existence and the conditions of that existence. And further, I have provided the proof required." So he basically, you know, said that this being exists. And, you know, he says what he envisioned in his mind, this person tall, dark man in his 30s, well-knit, active and strong, with the face of a savage king and the eyes veiled, lest their gaze should destroy what they saw. But here's what he says about writing the 65-page book. Crowley says, "I was proud of my personal prowess as a poet, hunter, mountaineer of admittedly dauntless virility, yet I was being treated like a hypnotized imbecile, only worse, for I was perfectly aware of what I was doing. My own unconscious was thus in alliance with Iwas, taken between two fires. My conscious self was paralyzed so long as the pressure lasted." So, you know, he had this very important moment, and that Book of the Law would be the basis of all of his future religion. It was really a core document for everything that Crowley wrote in the future after 1904.
So you're saying that Aleister Crowley hand wrote the Book of the Law? Because I always thought it was Rose.
No, he claimed to have done it himself. He was kind of like the medium, and he said that that entity was over his shoulder.
All right, well,
dictated it to him. That's what my research led me to believe, according to what he said, really.
Okay. Well, I can buy that. You know, it's just often the women are the channel. And
I think for sure she was the initial channel, and all of his scarlet women were initial channels for him in the future as well.
All right.
So for sorry.
One thing I was thinking about is that Stella of Revealing, just another nod to Crowley at the museum. They still have, although the Stella has been moved to a new place, they kept the 666 plaque in the display.
Interesting. Do you know what's also interesting? People still travel there for certain dates on April 8th, 9th, and 10th to celebrate the receipt of the Book of the Law.
Wow. You know,
one person, one devotee of Crowley actually traveled there for the 75th receipt of the Book of the Law, and his name is James Page, or otherwise known as Jimmy Page.
Of course. Yes. Of course. Ended up buying his house in the Loch Ness. And
correct.
Yeah.
It's a Boleskine Manor. Yeah.
So in the Book of the Law, it clearly states that I am the hawk-headed Horus and I pluck out the eyes of Jesus.
Correct.
So
he also references my number as 11 and the numbers of those who are us. So that's an important Crowley number. But yeah, the last part of the, you know, it's broken up into three parts, but the third part is particularly vicious. The war god Horus viciously declares an age of wrath and death upon the earth. Basically, you know, I'm a god of war and vengeance is exactly how it starts. It starts with it. And then he says, you know, he basically, I mean, the god Horus insults all of the other great religions. He says, "With my hawk's head, I peck out the eyes of Jesus as he hangs upon the cross. I flap my wings in the face of Muhammad and blind him. With my claws, I tear out the flesh of the Indian and the Buddhist, Mongol, and Did. So I spit on your crapulous creeds."
Well, this prophet of evil, Aleister Crowley, definitely was on to something here when he started to outline this age of the crowned and conquering child and laid out the very formation of what we're seeing in the 24th century, saying that look at the games of chance, the many wars, and all of the indolences of the people today. Are we not children? And speaking that we are moving into the age of the crowned and conquering child. I mean, I see it in Bill Clinton's extramarital affair. I see it in the politics and the war, that this age of the crowned and conquering child is absolutely upon us, this age of horrors.
Yeah, I mean, he always talked about it as the birth of the child, you know, the child, this kind of cosmological change. And he actually kind of estimated later on in his life that it would start in the 60s. And then you have Timothy Leary basically saying the same thing. I am, I'm a believer in Aleister Crowley. Had a beautiful, I mean, I can't remember exactly what he said verbatim, but to paraphrase him, he said, you know, I'm carrying on the work of Aleister Crowley. And there's the 60s, this era that, you know, Crowley typified, this year of magic and drugs and, freedom, human freedom away from any of the old kind of Christian or, you know, Hebrew creeds or dictates.
Right. Well, whatever happened to poor Rose?
Rose actually went kind of mad. She became a heavy duty alcoholic. She was drinking, tons of bottles of alcohol, and she ended up in an asylum, like a couple other of Crowley's Scarlet Women.
Wow. So did these Scarlet Women play into the AA? How did that get formed, and what?
Once Crowley kind of came back from the Book of the Law, he really actually put it down for a while. I don't think he fully understood it, but he, came back to England, and, you know, his wife was, you know, one of their daughter died, the name's Lola Zala, and that's why Lola Zaza, excuse me, and that's why his wife started drinking heavily. But he decided to create this kind of universal magical system called the AA. And it was a magical system anybody could do. It was structured so that there would only be one person above you to follow. It was called the Astrum Argentum, which references the silver star of the moon. It's a very intense, rigorous training system that, is based upon everything Crowley had learned up until that time.
But at this point, he started to write some, let's talk about his poetry and his writing, because as he got to the Book of Lies, it seems that he had stumbled upon a secret that he was completely unaware of.
Well, he said the secret was basically sexual magic. It was something that he came across that other OTO members. See, Crowley became the head of the German OTO in 1925, but there were other people kind of doing similar things as Crowley at the same time. And he had a meeting with this guy named Karl Royce, who was the head of the OTO. And this Royce guy complained, said that Crowley was stealing his knowledge, but they both came across this kind of sexual magic around the same time during their investigations. And that was kind of, I think, what was referenced in the Book of Lies, if I'm correct.
Well, the original creation of the OTO, Ruse.
Yeah.
This was really an offshoot of the Bavarian Illuminati, was it not?
I think that's what they said. Yeah, that's what they claimed. And I haven't verified that. But, you know, the OTO was kind of like the same kind of order as the Golden Dawn. There were, you know, all kinds of occultism and magic and all that stuff. But, yeah, that's my understanding, is they claimed to offshoot.
Yeah, if you read what they actually claim, they claim to be the offshoot of everything from ancient Egypt to the Illuminati to, you name it.
Yeah, there's a huge long list of all these people. And then they named all these people who were either members or spiritual members. So people they wanted to be members of the OTO. And that's also a long list of people who had already been dead. So there's no way they could have been members. So, I've never been able to trace a direct line from the Illuminati to the OTO or the AA or, you know, any of these other organizations. I just don't have that information.
All right. Well, the real purpose of this magical order, known as the Ordo Templi Orientis, just for those listening, and is translated as the Order of the Eastern Templars, is absolutely then for related into Freemasonry and many other, although it's an outer body, it's not an actual part of, but beyond Freemasonry, the OTO, they work on the idea of the invocation of various deities through this mental imagery and engaging in sexual practice, right?
That's my understanding, yeah, something like that.
So the real purpose of this is contact with, let's call them extra-dimensional beings.
Yes, I think that that's true. And Crowley was trying to create contact with those beings all of his life. I mean, that was really the whole step. I think a Christian would call them demons, but he had contacts with AWAS through the Book of the Law. He had another one called, there was another one where he wrote Book 4, which was in Italy. And there were all these other entities that he was trying to come in contact. But he also through his whole life, he was trying to contact AWAS all the time. Those were kind of his main prayers from his writings and his diaries.
Well, he seemed to have a huge fixation with semen.
Absolutely. I think that this was a standard kind of occult thing where, you know, the sexual practices were vitally important or core elements to his teachings. If you see his logos and his Mark of the Beast and everything, there's always a phallic quality or phallic theme to it. And basically when he wrote his, you know, a lot of his rituals, they included what were called the cakes of light, and the ingredients were basically unmentionable, but they included, you know, what you spoke about earlier.
Yeah, semen and menstrual blood. You know, that's in Lady Gaga's perfume.
Well, she's keeping up the tradition then. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, it carries on. You know, we see our celebrities putting out these hand signs and gestures. We see Jay-Z with his Do What Thou Wilt t-shirt. And, you know, back to the sexual nature, the Visica Pisces is the symbol that sits outside of the OTO's logo. It has the Visica Pisces with a dove coming down into the Holy Grail. And as we study, and we have a book called Weird Stuff, that we outline the different hand signs and gestures. And a lot of people will see that hand sign with a lot of the celebrities, even Justin Bieber, putting the hand, their, like the okay symbol. And most people will say that this would equate to 666. But when you start to research the actual magic and the insides of the ideas of the true signs and symbols of these hand signs, you find that this okay 666 symbol is really a sign of the Visica Pisces, which is the womb. And
interesting. I mean, it's all those teachings are still there from Crowley. You know, Crowley was like a central figure for, you know, grabbing all that information from occultism prior to his, you know, his ascension really at the turn of the century. So he knew all about past, you know, occult masters. He actually thought he was a resurrection of a French magician who also influenced Albert Pike. And his name was Alphonse. Oh, God, now I'm blanking on it. It was
Cagliostro? No.
No, he actually did reference Cagliostro. It was
Alphonse. What's his name?
Totally blanking on it. I should know this offhand.
Yeah, it happens.
Eliphas Levi, excuse me.
Oh, Eliphas Levi. Of course, the creator of the well-known Baphomet, which is also prevalent throughout all of our modern pop culture.
Yeah, Crowley thought he was the resurrection, or the resurrected body of Eliphas Levi. So.
All right. Yeah, and That did play heavily into Albert Pike's work. I mean, he was a huge fan of Levi.
My understanding is I haven't like compared and contrasted their writings, but I've heard people say that the Morals and Dogma is almost a direct ripoff of Eliphas Levi.
It is. And I have the commentary from the Supreme Council of the 33rd on Morals and Dogma, and they're constantly saying, well, you just got to take this at whatever, because Pike was such a Levi lover that, you know, we don't know what he's talking about here.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing that Eliphas Levi influenced two people of such great import like Pike and Crowley.
Right, and amazing how much this occult sits within our structure of civilization.
Agreed, and not a lot of people are aware of it. And it's still, you know, it's so many people Crowley touched. I mean, it's pretty amazing that one of Crowley's associates and followers, and somebody who's very close to him, was Aldous Huxley, who was an incredible influence. You know, one of the things that you can find proved that a lot of his biographies didn't prove at the library there in Austin, Texas, the Ransom, is that Crowley painted a picture of Aldous Huxley when he was in Berlin in the early 30s. And so that's a direct connection that Huxley never really wanted to emphasize, as far as I know.
This guy sounds like Hitler and Walt Disney all rolled into one.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, it's amazing that you reference Hitler, because one of Crowley's close followers was a guy named J.F.C. Fuller, who was a fascist in England. He had basically invented the kind of notion of tank warfare, and he was one of two people invited to Hitler's birthday, 50th birthday in Berlin. So you have a direct connection between J.F.C. Fuller, Crowley, and Hitler, and their similarities are pretty stunning in outlook. If you you can Google online, I wrote a paper called Crowley and Hitler, and basically show how similar in outlook they were.
Well, we know Hitler was heavily into theosophy, carrying around the books of Blavatsky.
Yes, very much. And quoting, there's even one researcher who's made a pretty bold connection between Crowley and Hitler, that Hitler was actually quoting some elements of Book of the Law, and I haven't been able to verify that.
Wow.
That would be incredible, because, you know, it just would change the whole purview of the Second World War. And Crowley, I mean, Hitler was a really a master occultist in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of the stuff he said, I mean, he referenced magic, he referenced all kinds of stuff like Crowley, but a lot of the viewers of Hitler kind of view him as a political leader instead of kind of a spiritual, magical type character.
Right, you got the whole Thule society, and again, channeling interdimensional beings, utilizing ritual magic.
There it is, you got it. I mean, it's the same thing. And there's actually one of Hitler's influences was this guy by the name of Sabbatendorf, one of the many people who influenced Hitler. But he and Sabbatendorf was an occultist of kind of the OTO stripe, and there's also a connection between him and Crowley. So it's very interesting how these people come across each other. And even like some of Crowley's followers today are connected, whether it's Kenneth Anger and Manson and LaVey. These people, I mean, there's pictures of Anger, who is a direct follower of Crowley, and LaVey, two people who were influenced by him and had incredible impacts upon our modern kind of culture.
What was the film Kenneth Anger made?
Invocation of My Demon Brother, that one, or was it Lucifer Rising?
Yeah, Lucifer Rising is the one I was thinking of.
And here's the big finish on Lucifer Rising. You have Kenneth Anger in front of the Sphinx. You know, this cult concept of what the Sphinx represents is important in occultism, and it goes back to Eliphas Levy. And then, you know, he's sitting in front of the Sphinx, and there is the UFO comes over the top of that.
Right.
The big finish.
Right.
So what's going on? So then there's that whole thing within people, what are UFOs? And some, you know, definitely in the Christian community, a lot of people believe UFOs are demonic entities.
Yeah, and we're gonna dig more into that. I don't want to lose sight of the OTO at this moment, because I'm just curious about this type of ritual magic and the ideas, because it seems that there's... You talked about the suffering of the Scarlet Woman, the women that were their channels, and we're looking at a lot of anal sex. We're looking at a lot of possible trauma abuse. Can you outline a little bit of that within these OTO rituals?
Yeah, I think, you know, he basically had very defined rituals of all different types. He had Cross of a Frog, which is like you torture a frog, and then it's really awful. You know, all of his Scarlet Woman had the Mark of the Beast branded on their chest. A lot of people don't know that. So Crowley literally took a brand and branded this Mark of the Beast on the chest of these girls. So
do you know what that mark was?
The Mark of the Beast was the confluence of all these different planetary signs with a phallic emblem. So you can look up or just Google Crowley Mark of the Beast, and it'll show you a specific kind of graph, or not a graph, but icon.
Okay, because in the study of Kenneth Grant and looking into the Typhonian Order, and Kenneth Grant was a follower, accolade of Aleister Crowley, he wrote these books on the Typhonian Order and mentioned the Mark of the Beast, and it turned out to be, well, the X-Men logo, O and an X. And
yes,
You'll see this on Russell Brand's Brand X. We'll see it on XO with Beyonce. You'll see it on Michael Jackson's Escape album. You'll see it on the back of the head of the high priest of the Church of Satan, in case anyone thinks that this is just random.
Those X's are very common. It's also a symbol of the Antichrist. So you'll see that X on the forehead of Charles Manson. And it's also on the top of Crowley's Seal of Babylon. You can look up Crowley's Seal of Babylon. So, you know, these guys do follow these symbolic, you know, meanings. They're very consistent between different people and different groups.
I have footage of an Egyptian stela, and this is just a random side note. You know, it's ancient Egypt, and yet there is the O and the X symbol, and it's right next to an inverted cross.
Like, really?
How strange is that, right?
Very strange. I mean, the thing is when you go into Crowley and his influences, you get into really high weirdness, high strangeness. You know, it's just amazing the people he's influenced and how those people are still influencing the world today.
So were these massive orgies, were there things that were going on that were they eating fecal matter as they were performing these type of, and these are the things we hear in the tabloid exploits of Aleister Crowley. People locked into rooms, forced in you know, feces and forced to eat it, anal sex, rape, all of these type of things. Is this legitimate for this type of magical practice?
I think so. I think to a certain extent, Crowley admitted to eating human flesh. He did rituals with excrement and urine and all kinds of stuff. He had close followers who admitted that that's what he was into. So it's hard to get somebody to write about their orgies or something like that. But definitely Crowley himself references times when he's naked with a bunch of people. So the specifics are hard to come by, but all the references are there. So I have to assume that that was it. And Crowley believed that he had that kind of view of, you gain power by doing things that are repulsive. So, you know, the whole thing about his sexual preferences were there to garner that kind of energy for himself and his magic.
And they claim these are the keys to masonry and hermeticism themselves.
I think that some of them are. Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly how those are references, but Crowley himself called, you know, what he called the key, we would call sodomy.
Right. That's what I thought.
Yeah, no, it's definitely there. I mean, he believed sodomy was the doorway to hell. He believed, you know, it just was, there's so much of that involved in all of his practices. And that was really his preference. I think he was really preferentially a homosexual, although he had women, and his opinion of women was extremely low. So when I hear of people who are females who joined the OTO, it's pretty much of a shock. Like I heard that Peaches Geldof was a member of the OTO, or she was dabbling with it. I don't really know.
Yeah.
Before, do you know who Peaches Geldof is?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she had it tattooed to her arm. She had OTO
right.
Yeah.
That's right. So yeah. So yeah, it's just Crowley had a pretty perverse view of the world for sure.
Well, then he gets all mingled in with Jack Parsons, L. Ron Hubbard. Next thing we know, we're looking at modern rocketry.
Yeah, it's really incredible because the first OTO kind of place outside of, I think, Europe was this place on Orange Grove Road in Pasadena with another kind of privileged son, this guy Jack Parsons, who his actual real name is Marvel. And here's this guy who started Scientology's there. They actually had the same, Crowley, at one point, he started his own abbey. He called it the Abbey of Thelema. Thelema meant will, and which is a very important concept in most magicians. And will, actually, when he put it into the gematria, added up to 93, which is one of his important numbers, which goes back and kind of ties into 9/11.
Yeah.
But interestingly, when he started his Abbey of Thelema, he was inviting all these other people to come down from England to learn at the feet of the master. But he had this interesting L.A. figure who was an L.A. actress, not super successful, but her name was Jane Wolfe, and she sat and sat at the feet of Crowley and learned from him. Well, here you go. What happens when they consecrate the new OTO or Crowley chapter here in Pasadena? Here is this lady, Jane Wolfe. This is all recorded. Jane Wolfe holding the Stella of Revealing, you know, consecrating this temple in Pasadena. So there's an absolutely direct tie between Crowley, Parsons, this lady, Jane Wolfe, and all these people. And who's hanging out with Jane Wolfe and some of these other people? Kenneth Anger and all these other kind of famous magicians. And Kenneth Anger is still alive. It's really incredible. He actually gave kind of a talk on Crowley at the Hammer Museum here in LA.
Wow.
Yeah, and you can look that up online. It goes through Crowley, and here's Kenneth Anger talking. Who's Kenneth Anger's benefactor? J. Paul Getty, a scion of the Getty family. He would pay any airplane flight that Anger wanted to take, Getty would cover.
And what are the Getty famous for?
Oil money, huge oil money. But they had when John Paul Getty died, who was the family heir, he left a billion dollar trust, and it created two big museums here in Los Angeles. One's right on the cliff; it really overlooks all of LA, and it's just a family of incredible aristocracy and wealth who are here, you know, having a direct connection to this Crowley follower Anger. And actually, J. Paul Getty, who was super rich, he used to do. He was known to get into caskets and come back out, so he would do all these rebirthing rituals and stuff like that.
Wow. You know, and these are the guys in charge.
Yeah, it's crazy. And J. Paul, like this guy Getty, if you hear his history, he's like hanging out with the Stones. He's doing, you know, hanging out with models. And I mean, just it's incredible. He's a heroin addict. So all of the same kind of themes that like Crowley was, this guy was, this kind of, you know, drug taking, hard, you know, kind of like with the themes of hard rock, you know?
Yeah, it seems that the aristocracy, the elite, are quite bored.
Yeah.
And just, you know, have to dabble, and then it eventually leads them to Satanism, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Crowley basically is a Satanist. He just was a very sophisticated one, and he had all kinds of secret techniques and stuff, and I think that there are even, I mean, I didn't research kind of Crowley's connections to wealthy families, but there's a connection between some of the earlier aristocratic families of New York and Crowley, the Astors, and people who are known to come to Crowley. Crowley was in New York as a British spy from about 1912 to 1918. He was working, trying to destabilize the German support here in the U.S., and also still practicing magic and hanging out with, you know, the cognoscenti and literati and all these people in New York. It's really incredible.
It is amazing, and amazing how much influence this man had and how few people really know about anything about Aleister Crowley. You know, it's not
really publicized, but you have so many important figures. You know, you have like Alan Moore, who's a huge writer of comic books. He's not even a drawer, but he's written all these works that we see all the time. Like
V for Vendetta, From Hell.
From Hell,
the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah, what's the one about the about all the kind of guys at the end of the world, the superheroes?
Oh yeah, Watchmen.
Watchmen, thanks. Yeah, so then Watchmen. So he's written all these, and his things are, you know, basically full of kind of Crowley cultism and stuff like that.
Oh yeah,
Crowley's birth, like the real followers of Crowley, the hard ones, hardcore ones. Celebrate a day when Crowley was born. It's October 12th. So they like he has all these October 12th references in his stuff.
He has Crowley's motto in there, the five V's. You know, and here you can see again the influence of this man as the protest and the we see the occupiers running around with their Guy Fawkes masks, never knowing that all the teachings inside of the comic book, V for Vendetta, or graphic novel more properly, are based off the beliefs of Adam Weishaupt and the Bavarian Illuminati, coupled with the beliefs of Aleister Crowley. I mean, it's right there.
I think that there's even a direct reference where the main character says, you know, do what thou wilt.
Do what thou wilt. Sure, it's all in there. Absolutely. And I firmly believe that the reason Alan Moore took his name off the movie was because the movie left every bit of that out of it.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and then you have like H.R. Giger. A lot of people don't know that guy was an OTO member. If you look at his drawings and stuff like that, he has kind of rewritten or redrafted kind of the book, The Stella of the Revealing. And that guy did all of the, you know, artwork for the Aliens movies.
Right, absolutely. And
Jim Morrison on the back of their album had a bust of Crowley, and he's making like a hand sign. And Jim Morrison was heavy duty. You know, he knew a lot about Crowley and other kind of black magic stuff. He's like that Jay-Z that you talked about earlier with the Do What Thou Wilt. I mean, it just goes on and on. Zeppelin, Page,
Bowie, Beatles.
The Beatles, Bowie, Rolling Stones.
It's quite amazing. And here's this band no one knows of, and you know, yeah, like you were saying, he was a secret agent. You know, he was in MI6, and it was said that he actually taught the peace sign to Winston Churchill, which the peace sign is literally the sign of Typhon, which is, for those listening, the beast of the abyss. And he taught Winston Churchill, who was a 33rd degree Freemason, this peace sign to battle the solar forces of the Nazi swastika.
Yeah, it's crazy. And even, like, apparently Crowley's handler was the writer of the James Bond movies during World War II. So, actually, that guy, he...
Ian Fleming.
Ian Fleming, thanks. He actually modeled his first villain on Crowley.
Right. Last movie, first book.
Right, I think so. So, like, they were supposed to, I didn't see it, but it was supposed to be, like, a kind of corpulent, corrupt figure that I think the last name is Schiffre, Schiffre. Does that sound right?
Yes.
So I think that was, he actually wrote that was a Crowley model. So.
Yeah, and when you look into Ian Fleming's early works, especially the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, right? Written supposedly for children, but absolutely is a child napping book, you know, kidnapping story where the queen hates children, sends out the candy man to abduct the children and keep them in cages. And supposedly this movie was shown repeatedly to Princess Diana by the queen.
Really? That's amazing.
That's creepy, right?
It's creepy. It's very creepy. But it was eventually killed by probably the royal family, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, they got their breeding done and she was out of there. I personally think they needed to bring a little more human DNA into the equation to keep from transforming or something, you know?
Yeah, she was actually kind of like, when you look at them all together, she's like the normal one, man.
Oh, yeah, poor girl.
See, it's really sad.
She used to literally say they're lizards.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know that, but she also wrote that note that says they're going to kill me in a car accident, and there they go. They killed her in a car accident.
Right.
I mean, that note, and I mean, God, the stuff she had to go through, like, she just bristled at all the controls. You know that they gave her a they gave her a gynecological check before she got married to the prince. They had to make sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, I couldn't imagine being involved in that.
Yeah.
You know, and poor Kate now. Ugh, yeah.
It's the trade-off, right? You probably get the money and all that stuff, but holy smokes.
Yeah, then you die. Well, in magic and theory and practice, Crowley openly states that it's best to sacrifice a human boy of blonde-haired and blue-eyed descent, and you can gain the most power out of that. Do we really believe that there is human sacrifice going on from these type of belief systems?
Do I believe? I think that, in certain instances it does happen, but, I think it's all very covered up. I don't know, you know? I it's not something that you can find a lot of, research on.
But no, they're not going to publish.
Yeah, I'm not going to publish it, but I can tell you that satanic crimes are actually very common, satanically influenced crimes, people who think they can gain power from ritual magic. It's hard to confirm it. Crowley himself, not just in magic and theory practice, but he also in other places referenced child murder. If you read the World's Tragedy, that references child sacrifice, and also he thinly veils ritual sacrifice in his book Liber 66. So if you read book 66, it's basically about child sacrifice and the blood shall be as wine. And
now again, that number 66 is related to the abyss. It's the dark side of the tree of life and related to the fallen angels.
Yeah, so he knows all that. So right. All those numbers, you know, when he did his whole system, he broke up his books into numbers based upon important gematria or other, you know, history. So he had Liber 11 22 33 44 55 66. You know, it's interesting you say that because it's pretty black. But then Liber 77 is called his Book of Oz, or basically his political paradigm. And it basically says, you know, the slave shall serve, which is a quote from the Book of the Law. And it also says, if anybody thwarts your rights of freedom, kill them.
Right. That's a very satanic belief.
Yeah. I mean, so it's really vicious. And I think, you know, Crowley himself admitted that. So going back to child sacrifice, I do think there are references there, but it's hard to ascertain. You know, it's
sure.
not. I actually just got done watching the full thing of True Detective. Did you get a chance to see that?
No.
Yeah, that talks about child sacrifice, pedophilia, ancient religions. It's really well written and actually has some tie-ins to Crowley. But and like The Wicker Man, it's pretty fascinating.
Have you seen the movie Crowley by the Bruce yeah. Dickinson of Iron Maiden?
Yeah, I've seen it twice.
Yeah.
I think the acting was actually good, but the production values were a little shabby. And I think that Dickinson is kind of an admirer of Crowley, so I didn't like that take on it.
Right. Yeah, it was pretty wild. That's all I can really say about that.
But I mean, you know, I think that it was actually pretty honest in a lot of ways. I think that the first scene in there where they had the English actor behaving like Crowley when he was at his kind of boarding house called Netherwoods, it was in Hastings. I thought that was really well done, because people who had visited Crowley basically said he was a junkie, and there was this, you know, his room was redolent with corruption, with all these old magical books and all this stuff like that.
Well, Crowley died just a couple of months after Roswell.
1947.
So how does this all relate to the ufology?
You know, the interesting thing about Crowley is he had, you know, one of his many communications with entities, he wrote something down about this communication with this being called Lamb. And Lamb was kind of an honorific, but he drew it in one of his notebooks, actually published it in The Equinox, which was his encyclopedia of occultism. And there's this drawing of a gray alien before anybody ever discussed notions of gray alien or had contacts with gray aliens. There it is, probably published between 1910 and 1920. And it's really just a remarkable tie-in to the whole UFO research and phenomena that's taken place after, you know, 1950s.
Wow. But do you feel Crowley is the prophet of this 21st century? Do you think he was really onto something as he outlined what seems to actually really be going on right now?
Yeah, I think that he really did try to change the world. He really wanted to create cosmological change on the Earth. He thought himself as a prophet of that aeon. Whether he prophesied the future well, I think that there was so much that changed from him, the drug use and the kind of sexual libertinism and the kind of change away from, you know, institutionalized Christianity, whether it's in the schools or the homes. You know, I think that he definitely helped make that change happen in the world, and his followers and his kind of like devotees really assisted him, whether it was Kinsey, Anger, whether it was the musicians through Led Zeppelin or anything like that. I think that, you know, he has to be seen as this kind of important figure in the 20th century.
And we can pretty clearly state that he was a Satanist.
Absolutely. There's no question he was a Satanist. What he did is he was in a time where he had to, you know, veil his writings and everything. So he called Satan Awaz, Lord of the Air, which is pretty thinly veiled. Like, if you know the Christian tradition, Satan is defined as the Lord of the Power of the Air different places. So, you know, it's clear to me that that's what he's doing. He's definitely, I mean, what he said pretty starkly was that he wanted to be Satan's right-hand man. And I think that in a lot of ways he did achieve that. You know, he really spent his time, working on, you know, becoming this kind of like the greatest Satanist in human history. You know? And I think that all of his writings and everything he left really, you know, showed that was what he was up to.
William Ramsey, he is the author of Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11, and the New World Order. And he's going to join us now in the members section as we start to discuss a little deeper and darker topic, getting into satanic ritual murder with the West Memphis Three and the Process Church. And we're going to dig much deeper into the symbolism encoded into the tragedy that we know of as 9/11. pretty soon you will understand exactly why it happened on that day and why those planes were the very planes necessary to pull off this magic ritual. So join me and William right now as we move to the members section. And thank you all for tuning in here live to the Free Zone.